Devon alone these days, her daughter emerging from her dark bedroom only to take showers, her shoulders hunched, hair covering her face, as if she were no longer a gymnast at all.
"Gwen," Eric said, training those gray eyes on her. "Look what Bellstars has done for Devon. She's on track to compete nationally. Your daughter can bloom here. We can do this together. We can make Bellstars a place all our girls feel challenged and supported, motivated and inspired. There's only one thing stopping us. One investment we need to make together."
"And what is that, Eric?" Gwen said, eyes narrowing.
"What else?" he said, smiling lightly. "A pit. We need a pit."
And remarkably, Gwen nodded.
"Of course we do. Gwen likes the soft sell," Coach T whispered to Katie, shaking his head in wonder. "And no one sells softer than Eric."
And that very night, all of them flush from old wine and something called drunken prawns, they walked into Gwen's study and watched as she flipped open her massive white leather checkbook binder and, fountain pen in hand, signed in her swirling script. All for that in-ground landing pit, which, Katie calculated, cost more than a year of their mortgage payments.
"It's a must for elite training,"
Gwen told Katie, as if Katie didn't know.
As if those very words hadn't come directly from Eric himself. "We shouldn't skimp on our children's dreams."
"No," Katie said, "we shouldn't."
"It's a disgrace," she added, handing over the check, "that we've waited this long."
All of this Eric managed, as if he were born to it. It wasn't Eric Katie hadn't seen in years and years, maybe even since their first frenzied dates, those 7-8-hour adventures of shots and pool and soul-sharing, and Katie hanging over the edge of a mattress, breathless with wonder over him. 19-year-old Eric, who wanted so many things he couldn't begin to name them all, or any of them. More than a dozen years later, two kids, a creaking split level with water stains but strong beams, loose shingles but copper pipes, both working in jobs they wouldn't have chosen but wouldn't have fled. And where had all that energy, that exuberance, that sense of limitless possibility gone? For Eric, for both of them, it went to this. After all, who wouldn't do anything for one's child? Especially when that child worked harder and wanted something more than either of them ever had. Who wanted in ways they'd long forgotten how to want, or had never known at all.
"This is just the beginning,"
Eric said, unscrolling the design plan for Coach T's approval. Gwen flanking him, smelling strongly of perfume. Katie behind everyone, unable to see.
"We'll have to go dark,"
Coach T said, reading glasses slipping down his nose.
"And find another place to practice, but hell, I'm grateful."
During practice, high up in the family viewing section, all the parents could talk about was the pit.
"Teddy's been dragging his feet on this for years," Molly Chu said to Gwen. "And you and Eric, it's all because of you two. Our pit at last."
Gwen twitched a smile.
"It's simply required for a competitive gym," she said. "And why Teddy hasn't installed one is a major concern for me."
"The building owners wouldn't allow it," Molly said. "That's what he told me."
"He told me good spotting means you don't need one," Kirsten Seifert said. But there were whispers among the boosters that Teddy's true reasons were more personal, rumors of financial strain. Two sons at expensive colleges and one in law school, a house renovation, a new deck. It was his gym, of course. But given the high fees he charged, couldn't he invest more in Bellstars? And when Eric filled out the Booster Club's tax forms and saw how much Teddy paid himself, he had to admit to Katie it was frustrating.
"Well, now we have everything,"
Katie said, looking down at Eric on the gym floor, hands on Devon's shoulders, talking and talking and talking. Construction took place during the Summer Olympics, the Bellstars buzzing with Olympic fever, holding viewing parties, and even, among the boosters, a small betting pool.
Practice was relocated to the nearby middle school, an arrangement made possible, of course, by Gwen, though no one knew how. Meanwhile, under Gwen's vigilant watch, a crew of men of Portuguese descent worked seemingly around the clock to dig the pit, splitting the floorboards like matchsticks, pouring concrete all day. When one of them fell ill, a substitute worker arrived in the form of Coach T's pool boy, a lean-hipped young man named Ryan Beck. This was how Ryan came into their world. Chapter 3. The foot might have been an end. Instead, it turned out to be the beginning. The fall might have been an end, too, were it not for the pit, which offered a second chance. But the pit brought Ryan Beck, and Ryan Beck, that sweet, chip-toothed, handsome young man, well, he ruined everything in his own way. Walking into Bellstar's with Drew, Katie caught her first glimpse of Ryan, with his long, tanned arms swinging a piece of rebar like a baton, laughing at something one of the workers had said. Ryan was always laughing. Over the next 2 weeks, everyone came to watch the construction of the pit, and to see Ryan. Each morning, he stripped down to his undershirt, jeans hanging low on his waist, and climbed down into the pit, 8 feet beneath the gym floor. And then it began, all the gymnasts, ages 7 to 17, making excuses to visit, taking turns, peeking over the pit edge, hoping for one of his smiles. And many of their booster moms, too. But it turned out Ryan was already taken by Haley, everyone's new favorite tumbling coach, who tended with such great care to the younger girls, hands on their curling spines, their sprigged thighs, somersaulting them. The pair had been spotted sharing French fries at the Sunday house, their foreheads nearly pressed together, like Archie and Veronica. "I'm glad for Haley," Gwen said, and all the mothers agreed, because Haley was adored, and no one knew why she had so much trouble keeping a boyfriend. Soon enough, Haley started coming to the gym, too, arriving in her sprightly purple car and sitting at the center of the bleachers as Ryan worked, and leaving only when practice required her to. Finally, the other girls got the hint and stayed away. Only little Drew remained. He was supposed to be in the game room, but Katie and Eric found him hovering a few feet from all the activity, watching the concrete mixer spin and whir. Inside the pit, Katie could see the back of Ryan's head, the delicate curve of his neck. Earbuds in, he smoothed the concrete with the power trowel, his arms floating back and forth gracefully. "Ryan said it was okay to watch," Drew told them, "if I stand back just this far."
"Well, he doesn't know," Eric said, pulling Drew away by his jacket hood. "He's just a kid. He doesn't know what's safe."
As if he had heard, Ryan glanced up at the Knoxes but only grinned. Looking down, Katie wondered how deep they would go digging that pit. How deep Teddy and Eric would make them go. Ryan seemed so far down that he might disappear. After that, while Eric took Devin to practice, enduring her stony silences, Katie chaperoned Drew at Bellstar's to view the progress. The installation of the rebar grid, the curing and coating of the walls, the padding on the edges glued and screwed down. And the best part, the filling of the pit, with the vivid colored foam cubes, cobalt and gold, tumbling down into it like alphabet blocks.
"You sure are a nice mom," Ryan once shouted up at her. "Bring in your boy every day."
Katie smiled, her face warm. The grand opening of the pit took place on the final day of the Olympics. As benefactor, Gwen led the christening, tossing in the final foam block, spray-painted gold by the level threes. Then her 9-year-old daughter, Lacey, leaped toward the runway, ready to perform the inaugural vault. But Gwen quickly put both hands on Lacey's tiny shoulders, patting her white blonde braids and pulling her aside as all paths cleared for Devin. Of course, Devin would be first. And more than 100 gym members, relatives, and supporters watched as she took the floor, shaking her fingers, breathing deeply. She hadn't vaulted since the disappointment, since qualifiers. Would she now? Lacey's alarming white eyebrows slanted like antennae, and she said something under her breath. Katie could hear Gwen's sharp response.
Well, life isn't fair, Lacey. Do you think I asked for these ankles? But you have to be strong and push through. We all endure a lot of things. I slept with your father's chainsaw snores every night for 6 years. I have him to thank for my tinnitus.
You can sit through this. Watch how it's done. Watch Devin.
Standing before the pit, padded on all sides and filled to the brink with foam blocks, each one a jewel facet, Devin couldn't even speak. Her hand finding Eric's arm, she set her right foot on one of its soft foam edges, and then she looked up at her dad as if unsure. But he nodded, and she nodded. Across the floor, Katie found herself envying them the moment. It felt so potent. As everyone watched, Devin walked over to the floor of the vault runway, eyes on the springboard, the vault table, rotating her wrists, shaking them. Then at last, charging down that runway with no hesitation at all, her body soaring into a double-twist Yuchenko that made the whole gym gasp and ah before nearly disappearing into the gaudy pit. Everyone cried. Katie couldn't stop. Later that night, Katie found Drew at the kitchen table, viewing the Olympics closing ceremonies on her laptop.
Devin didn't want to watch, he said,
shrugging at the hallway leading to the den. Walking by, she saw Eric and Devin, absorbed in old footage of Devin's first meet, a bowl of popcorn between them. She almost felt like she was intruding.
There was such a look of calm on Devin's face, for the first time since elite qualifiers, that Katie found herself retreating, not wanting to disturb. So she sat at the table with Drew. The sound turned low so Devin couldn't hear the fireworks, the jammy-voiced children's choir, the big horns. After Drew went to bed, she could still hear Eric and Devin through the wall.
"The new vault table? It's the greatest ever, Dad," she said. "And my landings are sticking. I'm going to do better."
"Devin, you don't..."
"It won't be like that ever again, like at qualifiers. I am going to make up for everything."
"Hey, Devin," Eric said. And Katie could hear him shushing her, soothing her, telling her she was perfect as she was and that all he and her mom wanted was for her to be happy. Katie listened, closing the hot laptop to muffle it. The Olympics over, the foam pit and new equipment in place, along with a sense of renewed purpose, it felt like a spell had been broken. To celebrate, Teddy engineered a booster-sponsored overnight trip to attend something called Gymnastics on Ice at the state capitol. It would have been a forgettable experience had Haley and Ryan not been invited, and had Ryan not arrived 2 hours late, long after the post-show dinner, during which Haley texted helplessly at the table, certain he had perished on some remote roadside.
"What would I do, Mrs. Knox?"
An hour later, all the Bell Stars and booster chaperones looked on from their balconies at the Ramada as Haley and Ryan, resplendent as a pair of movie stars, bucked and brawled down by the pool. Or Haley did. You couldn't help but watch. Haley crying and casting the sunflowers he'd given her into the searing chlorine, and Ryan still as a statue, gently pleading. Or so it looked.
"Teddy must have taken a whole bottle of NyQuil to sleep through this," Eric said, coming up behind Devin. "Should I go down?"
Katie shook her head, watching from the sliding glass door.
"Why does he just stand there?" Devin asked. But she looked captivated, moving closer to the balcony edge, her toes curling there, her face open in ways Katie rarely saw.
"Give them some privacy," Eric said, summoning her back into the room.
"That'll be Devin someday," Katie whispered to Eric.
He gave her a queasy look in return that made her laugh. Everyone inside, Katie stayed a moment longer. Soon enough, as the sunflowers, dark and sodden, drifted across the acid blue surface of the pool, Haley had pressed herself against Ryan's chest, and all was forgiven. The next morning, Katie saw them in the lobby sundry shop, their arms around each other sloppily, their faces glazed with sex. Ducking behind a rack of energy bars, She tried to sidle past them unseen. She could hear Haley whispering over and over in his ear.
You make me crazy, baby. You make me crazy.
Turning sharply, Katie hurried into the lobby, thick with exultant 8-year-old Jimmies, high on mochas, nose high with whipped cream. But Ryan had spotted her.
Mrs. Knox, he said, running after her as Haley paid for something at the register.
What had she bought? All Katie could think was condoms, the word whirring in her head.
I'm sorry, he added, shoving his hands in his pockets. About last night, I saw you guys on your balcony. What a couple of jerks we were.
Young love, she blurted, trying not to look at Haley's ballet pink lipstick on his jaw.
Young idiots, he said, shaking his head.
His hair still wet from the shower, the wrinkled shirt. Boys that age, everything was so easy. And that ease was the centerpiece of their charm, wasn't it? You should enjoy it. It's a great time, she said without even thinking. You feel things so deeply.
But then you stop, he said, smiling. Feeling deeply?
She was startled to hear her own laugh, sharp and fast, almost a bark. Then, in an instant, Haley was behind him, smiling at Katie, giggling. This creep! Her arms wrapped tight across his chest like a shield. When they returned from the trip, Coach T convened a strategy meeting at his home. Mama T's famous sun tea and biscuits, Eric and Katie in those stiff-backed dining room chairs. Pulling out his flowchart again, he directed their pensive faces back to the track, dog-eared. Coffee rippled.
It's not over, he said,
his voice firm, eyes intent.
Not for our girl.
You think she can try again? For junior elite next year? Katie asked. They'd talked and talked about it, she and Eric, endlessly.
She could, Teddy said. But I think she feels like she's going backward, and she's aging out soon, and if she... She won't, but if she fails again... The crush to her confidence, the impact on her ranking.
So what are you saying? Eric asked. Tell us.
I didn't want to raise the possibility before, but that pit. It's a game changer, he said, slapping one hand on the damask tablecloth. Listen to me, you two. There's a loophole. A shortcut.
With the thickest marker he had, he drew a line that went from level 10 through the doomed junior elite and straight to the next arrowed box. Stopping there, he circled Senior Elite, drew a looping star around it.
You could do that? Eric asked. You could skip?
No one does that, Katie said. Do they?
Teddy looked at them, the pouches under his eyes quivering with intensity.
Very few, but there are exceptions.
He drew another line, even thicker this time.
And we all know Devon is deeply exceptional.
Eric nodded. Teddy nodded. Their eyes locked on each other's. After countless nights spent talking about Devon, raising money for the gym, watching footage of Devon's routines, standing below her as her feet fastened on the practice beam, the two of them didn't even need to speak.
And she stopped the clock, Coach T added. You know...
At first, Katie didn't. Then she did.
Devon's going to get breasts, Teddy, Katie blurted. And hips. And everything else. She's going to be a woman.
No one's disputing that, Teddy said, smiling tightly. After all, only Peter Pan gets to keep his baby teeth.
Katie turned to Eric, but his gaze was fixed on the chart, on the thick black arrow leading off the page.
But what if she doesn't want to?
Katie asked Eric that night, brushing their teeth side by side.
Is it even good for her, all this pressure? It's been so hard since qualifiers.
Well, we'll ask her, Eric said. She's the one who has to decide.
So they did. And her eyes shuttled between Katie and Eric, watching them, doing that one-sided lip-biting thing that meant she was thinking. Then she said,
Okay.
The plan was in place. The new one. For the next 20 months, Devon would compete as much as she could, increase her ranking and improve her prospects, and get better and better and better. It would mean out-of-town trips, out-of-state trips, invitationals, classics, all the state and regional and national competitions, which meant arrangements had to be made with Devon's school. Eric pleading Devon's case, pointing out this unique opportunity, her strong GPA, her immense promise. He would handle everything, get tutors, pay for private lessons, whatever it took. Then, in July of her 16th year, Devon would try for senior elite, the first qualifier of her 16th year. Just knowing they were back on the track, even if it was a new one, made everything better, brought order back into their lives. So Katie had forgotten about it, or tried to. The possibility that the foot injury could have been to blame for what happened at qualifiers, and everything that might mean. Until months later. She hadn't meant to do anything but deliver the laundry, the teetering basket of leotards and warm-up sweats, and change Devon's sheets. Tugging the mattress pad, that awkward crawl to the corner that pressed too close to the built-in bookshelf, her hand hit something soft. The felt fabric of a fat diary. I heart everything, across its crimson cover. The idea that Devon kept a diary and hid it between mattress and wall felt so charmingly old-fashioned or out of time entirely. Devon wasn't ordinary or typical in any way, after all. Katie, her hand on the cover, hesitated. These are the things you just don't do. But your child's privacy. What did it even mean after you'd spent so many years with your daughter's body at the center of your life? So much energy focused on whatever hurt most. The once sprained arm, the soft-backed left knee, the chest bruised after Devon drove her own knees into it. All the talk, the open talk about bras and panties, which ones might show during meets and lead to deductions, and when it was time for bikini waxes. And all those nights, hard strokes on her calf muscles, ice on her bar-bruised pelvic bones, on the inside of her beam-bitten thighs, and, not in years, but still rubbing Vaseline where the seams of her leotard rubbed and bristled. Katie opened the pages. Today, straddle jump, half, three-quarter, and full on the beam, working on giant half plus full giant half, giant full, toe shoot, double layout dismount. Entry after entry about gymnastics, chronicling the minutiae and photos of her favorite gymnasts glued onto pages, silver sharpied arrows and circles over their poses, stance, muscles. It wasn't a diary at all. It was more like a training log. 6 a.m. workout before school. Stretch, run for 15 minutes. Half hour of conditioning. 25 minutes stretching or ballet, then squat jumps and pull-ups, then start with beam. I had trouble with my front pike half, but the rest went okay. Coach says I am achieving. He pumped his fist at me 3 times. Reading it, standing the whole time, leaning against the window for light, Katie was struck by how different it was from her own private ramblings at 14, all boys and song lyrics and fake IDs and where to hide the purloined pint of Jack Daniels for Friday night. But then, closing the diary, her eye caught a photo pasted inside the back cover. A snapshot taken in that very room, her bedspread visible, the boomerang of Devon's mutilated right foot, close up. Under the light, her desk lamp, it looked like it was glowing. It was horrifying and beautiful. Why was it the picture felt more intimate, far more intimate than a secret disappointment, a boy crush confession? And why did looking at it feel even more like a violation? Beneath it, Devon had written, I had the dream again last night. The one where I look down and my right foot is 10 times its size with skin like scales. So I take a knife from the kitchen drawer, the one Mom has to use with both hands, and I chop it off. The blood is like a fountain. But Dad sees me and runs up the basement stairs. He ties his belt around my ankle and pulls it tight. The buckle is shining. You need this, he says, grabbing my foot,
twisting and molding it like art class clay. It's your superpower. And I know he's right.
What is this?
Katie thought, covering her mouth. It was like turning over a heavy rock and finding something alive there, wriggling, prying something open and pulling at its hot wires.
That can't be Devin,
she thought. Who was this girl? Katie put the diary back into its tight wedge and vowed never to look at it again.
Mom, Devin said that night, calling out as Katie walked past her doorway. Were you in here?
What? No, just cleaning. Why?
Nothing. I just thought maybe you were.
Katie didn't want Devin to see her face. She was worried her face would reveal something. All she could think of was the photo. And Devin's dream. The strangeness of the foot. The belt. But dreams were that way, weren't they? And they were private. Maybe Devin's only private things. Never again, she told herself. I won't be that mom. She needs some place to be herself, to be messy and sad and human, real, to be whatever she was becoming. Part 2. Necessity is what you do in life when there is only one path, choice, or desire. Nadia Comaneci, Letters to a Young Gymnast. Chapter 4. 18 months later.
Today, some of the most anticipated moments will be when Devin Knox takes the floor, the play-by-play announcer said, voice hushed, as if this were the Olympics. Just shy of 16, Devin has proven the most formidable talent in the region who has not yet gone elite. That may all change in 6 weeks, when she'll take her chances at the senior elite qualifiers.
High in the stands, Katie and Eric watched. The purr-purr of Devin's feet during her floor routine, the zinging violin strokes of Assassin's Tango skittering through the air. She was excelling. Katie had seen the routine 100 times or more, but it looked different today. She couldn't say why.
She's more confident, Eric said as if reading her mind. That's what it is.
Katie wasn't sure, but her daughter's body slithering on the mat, then rising, seemed alive in ways she had never seen before, her scarlet leotard like a flame, leaping and flickering and flaring hot.
Now the vault, the announcer said, punctuating with dramatic pauses. Miss Devin Knox.
Grabbing for each other's hands, Katie and Eric watched Devin wait patiently for her cue. Standing at the foot of the runway, the massive flip-into-spring invitational banner behind her, all the playfulness of her floor routine gone, Devin wore the face of a stone Artemis. It was remarkable when Katie thought about it. How her daughter, so strong already, her body an air-to-air missile, had metamorphosed into this force. Shoulders now like a shipmast, rope-knot biceps, legs corded, arms sinewed, a straight hard line from trunk to neck, her hipless torso resting on thighs like oak beams. Sometimes Katie couldn't believe it was the same girl.
She's up, Eric said, pointing to the judges.
Stick it this time, Knox,
someone called out behind them, and Eric's head swiveled around, red charging up his face. Katie pressed her hand on his arm, until he turned back to the floor. A moment later, she snuck a glance behind her, but instead of the heckler, her eyes snagged on Ryan Beck, his delicate face in repose. Like a sculpture, handsome youth.
Here she goes, Eric said, face still flushed. Here goes Devin.
On the floor, Devin bounded down the runway, her knees churning like pistons, face impenetrable. Leaping from the springboard, legs tight together, toes like arrows, she flew. Front handspring, double tuck, twist, and landing, a hard slap on the mat. Because, of course, Devin stuck it, her legs like steel pikes, her arms flung elegantly above her head, wrists bent, a ballerina pose.
Stellar performance, the play-by-play man intoned, which definitely bodes well for Miss Knox at qualifiers 6 weeks from today.
and after walking off the mat, she waved up at the crowd, at Katie and Eric. Puffs appeared like magician's smoke fairy dust, the chalk that never left her hands.
"You nailed it, champ," Eric said as they walked through the parking lot, Devin moving slowly, punch drunk. "When I saw that Yurchenko, my heart almost stopped."
"I got it. I finally got it," Devin said. Then she looked up at him with an expression Katie had never seen, almost obscene in its pleasure. "That's what it's supposed to feel like."
It almost made Katie blush, and Eric dropped his keys, flinching at the sound.
The triumph was short-lived. When they returned home, all the things postponed until after the meet. Laundry, groceries, printer out of toner, wrapping paper for Lacey Weaver's birthday present, rock salt for Drew's fourth-grade science project, toppled back into their laps. The evening blurred by, and before Katie knew it, she was crawling into bed. But a few hours later, a distant car radio, a radiator rattle, something woke her at 2 a.m., bringing with it that unexpected, that tantalizing thing, rousing to Eric's hands on her, one in her hair, the surprising way he came at her, like the world might break to pieces if he didn't have her, her face pressing into the pillow, the way he shivered against her after, clutching at her before sliding away. The other side of the bed seemed so far. She loved him so much. The next day, back at the gym for a 4-hour Sunday practice. But no one could find Coach T, and nothing began without the mighty T. Katie could not remember ever walking into the gym and not immediately seeing his retired colonel's brush cut, the expanse of his pink neck, the swath of his red polo shirt stretched across his former footballer's body, the lumbering gait of a longshoreman, and not hearing his bark. "Devon! Ice eyes, girl, come on!"
Except today there was no Teddy. 6 weeks before qualifiers, and he wasn't there. Nor was Haley, whose honeycomb locks, long past her shoulders, could always be seen even from high in the stands. It shouldn't have felt significant, Teddy's absence. But it did. Not just to Katie, but to the whole buzzing parent brigade.
"Where is he?"
Gwen said, her phone as ever in her hand like a weapon, a discus she might hurl.
"I don't get it," Molly Chu said. "I don't understand."
The girls in their scarlet leotards dotted the floor, the older ones doing split stretches, handstands, but the youngest ones ambled anxiously, hopping on their tiny red feet. Finally, the skills coaches began leading drills, but the feeling was haphazard without the organizing thunder of Coach T's voice, the pole star, the heart.
"You listen to Amelie's, Lacey Weaver,"
came the familiar flinty shout of Gwen Weaver, who was calling to her daughter even as she ascended the stands.
"You are wasting everyone's time."
From the beam, Amelie's grip on Lacey's tined legs, Lacey nodded. Hair as white blonde as a Hitler Youth's. Hands still cupped around her mouth, Gwen turned to Katie, two rows down.
6 weeks, she said, dropping her hands. Lacey's first shot at junior elite, and I just cannot get her to self-discipline.
Katie nodded. It'll come. But not soon enough, she knew.
I need to motivate her, like you did with Devin.
We didn't do anything, Katie said. Devin always motivated herself.
Lacey'll be 12 next month, Gwen said, not seeming to hear. You have to eat the apple when it's ripe.
15 minutes passed before Bobby V, the gym's administrator, walked in, an odd slump to his shoulders, his shoes squeaking on the waxed floor.
I have very bad news, he said, hands shaking slightly. There's been a car accident.
There were gasps, and Katie raised her head from Drew's science book. Scanning the gym quickly, she spotted Devin in perfect, straight-as-great pose, ribcage lifted, tummy in, toes forward.
"Our Haley, she..." Bobby started, voice rising high and stopping.
A whimper came from somewhere, a swooping gasp, breaths held.
"Not Haley.
Oh, God!
Came the scattered murmurs.
No, no, Bobby blurted, running a hand through his brush cut, just like Teddy's. All the men in the gym, like 1950s astronauts.
I'm sorry. Haley wasn't in the accident. It's Ryan, though. Well, he's dead.
Katie felt a jag in her chest. Ryan. Haley's sweet Ryan. He'd been in the stands just the night before, cheering the squad on. He'd been in the background for so much of their gym life, which was their life for the past 2 years. He was the one who once opened Katie's car door with a coat hanger to retrieve her keys, who'd rescued Devon's retainer from the bottom of the tumbling pit, who danced with all the moms at that booster tiki party a few months ago. Remember that? He'd even danced with Katie, the chip in one of his front teeth when he smiled. When he dipped her, everyone whooped, Katie's hair grazing the confettied floor. Several parents began eyeing the bleacher's steps anxiously, but not moving. Not yet. Forbidden from the floor during practice, they were helpless, like spectators behind glass. Katie's eyes fixed on Devon, on the tight braided knot at the back of her head, her rigid neck. Two rows behind, the booster parents drew closer.
Terrible, said Molly Chu, hands pressed to her cheeks. Just terrible.
I wonder if someone was drinking or texting, whispered Becca Plonsky, the social chair. Or drinking and texting.
God, Katie said. His parents, I don't even know where his family is. She vaguely remembered Haley saying his mother lived on the other side of the state somewhere.
Gwen, did you know already?
Molly asked. For the past year or more, Ryan had been working as a line cook at one of her Weaver's Wagons restaurants. You could see him through the kitchen window, under the bank of heat lamps.
No, Gwen said, shaking her head, tapping her manicure on her phone case, watching Bobby as he tried to comfort Amelie's, the other skills coaches. No, I did not.
We don't know much, Bobby said, clearing his throat over and over. He was by himself when it happened, and he died over at St. Joe's. Teddy's there with Haley now.
Down on the floor, the girls began clumping together, their leotarded backs hunching forward, shuddering like red birds. 14-year-old Jordan Seifert's palms were pressed against her eyes, her sparrow's body trembling. Off the beam now, Lacey Weaver had sunk to the mat, was sitting on her hands and staring up, searching for her mother.
Mom,
a voice said, and it was Drew, beside Katie, fingers on her arm. But at that moment, Devon's seal-slick head finally turned and Katie could see her profile, a faint quiver of her chin.
Mom, Drew said again, tugging on her sleeve. Shouldn't we call Dad?
Katie looked down at her son, that grave face, his long-lashed eyes. 9 years old, going on 90. He was only a few blocks away, catching up on work emails at a diner.
Eric, she whispered into her phone. Can you come here now?
I've still got another couple hours to go on this job, so she told him.
Oh, God,
he said after a long pause, a long breath. Ryan. That poor kid.
Moments went by without anyone knowing what to do, Coach T's absence creating a formless confusion. Bobby V fiddling with his clipboard, checking his phone, avoiding the parents' glare.
Bobby! Gwen shouted down to the floor. Are you going to keep us in the mama cage forever?
Bobby looked up, scratching his neck anxiously.
Yes, you can all come down here, comfort your girls, he said.
Spry Gwen was down on the floor in seconds, and the stands started unfilling with worried parents.
Taking two steps at a time, Katie hurried down, but Devon was nowhere to be found amid the sanity nuzzle of leotarded girls and all those identical ponytails.
I never would have gotten to level 7 without Haley,
little 4-foot-7 Cheyenne Chu was saying softly,
a hand dragging along the suede-top trainer block.
She was the best tumbling coach I ever had.
Her mother, Molly, palms still planted on the sides of her face, seemed unable to speak, staring plaintively at Katie. Honey, nothing happened to Haley, Katie said, touching Cheyenne's jutting shoulder. She'll be okay. But it was hard not to worry for Haley, Coach T's heart's darling. Soft lilt and side-tilting head, she'd become more than a tumbling coach. She pitched in at the fundraising car washes, sometimes bringing soy lattes for the parents who'd driven far, laughed with the girls, gossiped with parents, even told the occasional salty joke. And after every meet could be seen dangling one of those long tan swimmer arms around her uncle's neck and kissing his leathered cheek.
There she is, Drew said, startling Katie, who'd almost forgotten he was beside her. There's Devon.
He pointed to the far side of the gym, Devon lingering by the chalk bowl, face red from the dust. Just as she was about to push through the scrum, Katie felt a hand on her arm.
I think he was going to propose.
It was Becca Plonsky standing behind Katie, so close her fleece collar tickled Katie's neck.
I think he bought a ring.
No, Katie said. I don't think so. She wasn't sure why she said it or why she thought she might know better.
I don't think so either, Gwen said, walking up to them. After all, I sign his paycheck.
But Becca insisted she'd spotted Ryan at Ahi Jewelers the week before, his hands curled atop the glass cases rocking anxiously on his feet, the ribbed neck of his windbreaker zipped up over his chin.
No way, Gwen said, shaking her head. A boy who wants to get married doesn't duck his girlfriend's calls.
Before Katie could ask what she meant, Eric rushed up, face flushed, his phone nearly slipping from his hand.
I'm here, he said breathlessly, his other hand damp in hers. How's Dev?
Arms wrapped around Drew, Katie watched from outside Coach T's windowed office as Eric spoke with pouch-eyed Bobby, who kept shaking his head. When he returned, he pulled Katie aside.
A hit and run,
he whispered. Was Haley with him?
No, he said. The police are over at St. Joe's now, talking to the Belfours. But let's keep that quiet, okay?
Katie nodded. The police? And she didn't know how anything like that could be kept quiet. Not among these parents.
Sounds like it was instant,
Eric said, his face pinched.
Snapped his neck.
A picture came to her, Ryan Beck laughing at something someone said, rubbing his nape, sun-brown always.
Oh, Eric, Katie said, covering her mouth.
From several yards away, Devon turned and looked at them both. She couldn't have heard them, not with all the chattering parents and the yelps of the younger girls, but she seemed to. They walked over to her.
What happens now?
She asked, looking up at her dad.
We go home,
he said, gently tugging her ponytail.
And think good thoughts for the Belfours.
And no practice?
She said, looking down at her chalked feet.
Qualifiers are in 6 weeks.
Devon, Katie said quickly. Feeling eyes on them, parents, other gymnasts. Seeing Gwen and Becca turn and look at them, eyes were always on Devon.
Everyone needs to go home now.
Devon looked up at both of them, her palms pressed together in front of her, and nodded. The four of them made their way across the thronged gym floor, the families slow to disperse, the gymnasts seeming to find comfort in remaining there with one another. The lower-level girls, tender and pink-faced, hived together in their Bellstars leotards, their feet so light, dipping their heads in the quietest of sobs. Not so with the older ones, the level tens, who remained poker-faced, as they did after a big loss, an accident on the floor, with their matching solemn expressions, arms crossed, ponytails tight, and posture erect. The tens ranged from 10 to 17, but all looked the same age. Under 5 feet, each was one of two types, the ballerinas, graceful, sprightly, and pixie-ish, and the powerhouses, the corkers. Barrel-thighed,
thick-necked fireplugs who succeeded by strength and will and shoulders like a man's fists. All of them, Katie knew, had long ago learned to shake off, hide tears, even, it seemed sometimes, to sort of reabsorb them, draw them back inside so no one else could see. They had learned from watching Devon, though she had never needed to learn it herself. As Eric talked briefly with Gwen, with fretful Molly Chu, as Katie helped Drew pack up his things, Devon slowly drifted from them, walking farther and farther toward the empty center of the massive gym. Chapter 5
"I just can't believe it," Katie said.
"Who does something like that and just drives away?" Next to her in the car, Eric was making calls, talking on the phone with one booster after the next.
"Well, I know, yes, but we can't get into those questions yet, and you know it, Jim."
In the rearview mirror, Katie could see Devon's face, her eyes glassy.
"Do we send Flowerth?" Drew said.
"When Mr. Watts' wife died, you sent Flowerth."
"Yes," Katie said, relieved to have someone talking to her.
"We'll do it right away."
"And I'll call Teddy tomorrow,"
Eric said, setting down his phone, rubbing his face wearily.
"After they've had some time."
Then the car went quiet, just the pfft of the tires on the highway, and Katie flitted back into her thoughts. No one that young, with eyes so bright, and the loping walk of a boy who would live forever, be a boy forever, could die. Abruptly, Devon spoke.
"Poor Haley," she said, her voice high and grasping. "She loved Ryan so much."
"I know, honey," Katie said.
In the mirror, Katie saw Drew looking at his big sister, puzzled and maybe unnerved, as if he'd never seen her so openly upset. But probably he hadn't.
"I'm sorry," he said to Devon in that lisping voice of his.
Devon looked at him, startled like she'd forgotten he was sitting next to her.
"It's so, so sad,"
she said more quietly now to no one in particular.
"Nothing like this has ever happened before."
Staring helplessly into kitchen cabinets, wondering about dinner, Katie could hear through the laundry chute the whir of the treadmill from the basement. First canceled practice since February's snowstorm, and qualifiers 6 weeks away, Devon wasn't going to let her body go soft.
"I wish she'd just take it easy," Katie said.
"She needs to work off some of these feelings," Eric said, reaching out to knead her shoulder.
Neither of them was saying the thing they were both thinking. The rotten, rotten timing. Right before qualifiers.
"Becca said Ryan just bought Haley a ring," Katie said, remembering. "He was going to propose."
Eric looked at her.
"Oh, Jesus," he said.
Then after a pause,
"He was so young."
Katie drew a bath for Devon, even lit her favorite island nectar candles.
"It's okay to feel bad," Katie said. "We all liked Ryan." "Thanks, Mom," she said, but she wouldn't meet Katie's eyes.
Just like after a bad meet when she'd hide in the concessions area restroom, as if she'd been caught doing something shameful, as if everyone had seen her with her clothes off, or read her diary. The bathroom door closed behind Katie. They were never home this early, and for a few minutes Katie didn't know what to do with herself.
"Mom," Drew said from across the kitchen, "you said you'd take me to Petorium for more shrimp eggs."
"More?
What happened to all the ones we did last night?"
"The container spilled in the garage."
He pointed to the recycling bin, a squashed 2-liter bottle, its sides veined with crusting salt.
"I have to do it all again."
"Tonight?"
she asked. But he looked so anxious, she couldn't say no. On the drive, Drew seemed unmoored by everything, asking 100 questions about Ryan.
"But how do you know he died right away? How does breaking your neck mean you die?"
But once they returned home, the science project focused him. He looked so serious, measuring the rock salt, studying the dried shrimp eggs under the light, and taking notes, pencil tight in his careful fingers. And he never said anything about what happened. Seemed to have forgotten it deep in the marrow of his effort, of the winning project he was creating. He was like Devon that way. Nearly midnight, Eric clapped his laptop shut, lifting his handsome head and watching as she turned off all the downstairs lights one by one. She couldn't remember the last time they'd gone to bed at the same time. Eric working 50 hours a week, Katie working 25 from home, creating commercial logos, designing annual reports on her overloaded computer between carpooling, car repairs, more errands. They had such a meticulously coordinated schedule, calendar synced, pop-up reminders, both of them always needed somewhere and then always coming home to the rest of it. All their duties hung like heavy raiment over them all the time, only the sight of Devon spearing into the air, lifting them up. So it was nice to walk up the stairs together, the only balm on a gloomy day.
"I sent out a mass email," he said, "to try to settle everyone down."
Walking past him earlier, she'd seen his inbox filled with breast-beating messages from parents, the gym's Facebook wall cluttered with concern and prayers.
"What shocking news! Has anyone talked to Haley?"
God bless and keep him. He was loved by all.
"The Connors told me they already saw a wreath on Ash Road," he said. "They say it's that spot with a dangerous turn, the hairpin."
Lying in bed with the cruel clarity that can come in late-night thinking, Katie foresaw how hard this would be for the gym, a tear in the seam of everything. Ryan had been such a welcome and constant presence since that very first day he'd arrived at Bellstar's to help build the landing pit. That dark ruff of hair and easy smile, he was always around waiting for Haley in the parking lot at competitions. Who could forget him selling raffle tickets out of the Weaver's wagon, or wielding the power hose at the booster car wash, his T-shirt soaked through. The younger girls had squealed, whispering behind hands. The older ones, Devon's age, twitched and fidgeted helplessly, their faces red.
For the Bellstar's girls, he was that perfect crush age,
the older-than-high-school boy but not yet dad guy. So many of them homeschooled or marginally schooled, he was the only young man in their lives. Part of it was an infatuation with Haley, too, unerotic, probably, enchantments with Haley's sun-bleached hair and swimmer shoulders and womanly body so different from their own straight lines. Whenever anyone asked her why she hadn't been a serious gymnast herself, she'd laugh and say, "Not with these," finger guns aimed at her apple-round breasts. The girls marveled over Ryan's gallantry, the way he carried her gym bag, opened doors for her, bought her perfume and chocolate-covered raspberries on Valentine's Day. The flush of their love, his devotion. Even their lovers' quarrels, like the epic one at the Ramada Inn almost 2 years ago, were part of their allure. Their fights were exciting and always ended with a flashy clinch. And now he was gone, for all of them. "Being a girl is so hard," Katie thought, "and it only gets harder." The next day, Monday, they arrived to find no Coach T again, his absence like a new scar.
"I don't understand," Molly Chu said. "Why he can't at least be in communication with us?"
She looked at Katie.
"Have you heard anything? There's a rumor that the police are very involved."
"I don't know," Katie said carefully. "Aren't the police always involved with a hit and run?"
The other parents in the stands nodded, all eyes returning to the floor. Bobby V and the skills coaches were straining to simulate a normal day, but without Teddy, that great oak in the center, it felt awkward, stilted. There was a peculiar tension among the girls, all of whom wore the blank expressions and big eyes of figures in Keen paintings. No one would listen to the substitute tumbling coach pitching in for Haley, or to the half-hearted drilling by Amelie's. Girls kept falling. Dominique Plonsky rolled her ankle in the landing pit and limped off to her mother's arms. At the vault, Devon struggled with her Yuchenko, the first twist so painfully slow she couldn't make the second. Foot hopping on the dismount, her face dazed and puzzled.
Then from the corner of her eye, Katie spotted Gwen Weaver's approach.
That shimmering bob and sleek purple jacket. The one Molly Chu called a glamorack. "I went to Coach T's house to pay my respects," she said. "Haley was there, but he wouldn't let me see her. The doctor sedated her because they couldn't calm her down."
"How horrible," Katie said, shaking her head.
"It is," Gwen said almost impatiently. "And you know Haley's nerves run high under the best of circumstances. But I thought you might know more."
"Me?" Katie said. "Why would I know?"
Gwen shook her head, her eyes veering to her daughter, Lacey, charging down the runway, the number one vaulter in her age group. Lacey still couldn't approach Devon's talents at her age, much less Devon's age now, legs fused, all air and drive. When Devon's palms hit the table, everyone gasped. Up she went, a torpedo. What was gravity then? "Jump big, like you dream," Gwen shouted, one of her favorite motivational phrases. They both watched Lacey spring onto the vault table, lock into a handstand, mouth open, that slightly panicked look in her eyes always, like a wee bird that couldn't believe it was flying. Then somersault off. "Well, I'm sure Eric will hear more. Teddy confides in him," Gwen said, leaning on the riser, rocking on her knees. "Did you know Haley had to identify the body?"
"No," Katie said, wincing. She wondered how Gwen knew so much, but she always did.
Which gym let the girls skip levels, which one sandbagged, the parent lobby drama at the one on Route 7, and the gym over in Hartswood where a coach had a cozy live-in guardian situation with a 16-year-old gymnast. "His skull was crushed," Gwen said, and Katie felt her body tighten. "When I was little, my mom ran over our border collie, Hanro. I saw the whole thing from my bedroom window." She paused. "Obviously, this is much worse."
Neck snapped, skull crushed. Katie couldn't say anything, and she wanted Gwen to stop talking.
"That's why I never let Lacey have a pet," Gwen concluded, unzipping her jacket with a jerk and leaning back.
She thought of Ryan, that graceful, boyish body, how he moved so easily, his arm like a slip of silk sliding across Haley's shoulders. Head dipping. At Weaver's wagon, she'd always see him coming from the kitchen in his line cook apron, that bright ribbon of teeth, waving to the booster club, to Eric, to her.
"I have to go," Katie found herself saying, rising abruptly, gathering her bag, book, headphones. "I'm taking Drew to the museum after swim class. I'll be back." "Right," Gwen said. "Well, I'll talk to Eric later about everything. A plan."
"A plan?"
Katie felt her ponytail unfurling slowly from its band, but didn't want to stop to fix it. She hadn't intended to leave or take Drew to a museum, but now it seemed like the perfect thing.
"I wouldn't say it to everyone," Gwen said, lowering her voice and moving closer. "But we do have to think ahead. I don't need to tell you, elite qualifiers are 40 days away. I know Devon's had that clock ticking inside her for 2 years.
"You're right," Katie said. "You don't need to tell me."
"Teddy says he'll be back by tomorrow," Gwen continued. "But who knows if he'll be in any condition to address gym issues. I'm going to send out some feelers."
"Gwen, this isn't the time. It was just 2 days ago."
Conversations with Gwen often felt like assaults, and Katie never knew when to duck.
"Best to duck the whole time," Eric always said.
He suffered the most, from the constant emails, the way she tried to dominate at meetings, the courting of other club members for key votes. "Gwen took me to Haven for a spa day, and we talked a long time about the new floors, and I think the extra money is worth it. It's a safety issue, really."
"She's passionate," Eric once said with a shrug.
"She's passionate when you agree with her," Katie replied. She was nearly to the final set of steps, nearly free, when Gwen called out after her. "Oh, and Katie," she said, swooping down the steps like a falcon. "I meant to tell you, it was so nice of Devon to come to Lacey's party Saturday night. The girls look up to her so much. I always tell Lacey, do as Devon does."
"She wouldn't have missed it," Katie said. She couldn't summon much memory of Saturday as separate from any other night. Laundry, Lawrence Welk, bleeding from Mrs. Martz's house next door.
going to the dollar store late for rock salt for Drew. Had she gone to bed early? When had Eric taken Devon to the party? Had Devon had any fun at all? The only thing she could recall vividly was that 2 a.m. surprise, feeling Eric reach across, sleepily grazing the small of her back, the tenderness turning so quickly.